of anti-competitive, violent, extractive behavior in the market. And what we really need is for the federal government to intervene. Until this point, the federal government has not intervened to protect tenants. In fact, the government has been an enabler of some of the worst business practices. The government backs financing to the tune of $150 billion every year through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They issue government-backed loans to landlords across the country. And some of those same landlords are the landlords participating in these price-fixing schemes. So we need a regulatory agenda. This is not a problem that will be solved by simply building more housing, as the RealPage executives and a bunch of other sort of mainstream economists might suggest. And that regulatory agenda has to include tenant protections. It has to include rent caps. So Vice President Harris and current President Biden have been talking about rent caps. And as I said, that's a good thing. The thing that they're talking about, though, is simply a directive to Congress, and it's tied to a tax benefit.
We have 15 seconds.
So what we want to see is more assertive, proactive regulatory action from the executive branch and from the Federal Housing Finance Agency.
Tara Raghavir, we want to thank you for being with us. We'll certainly stay on this with KC Tenants and the newly launched Tenant Union Federation. And thank you to Heather Vogel, ProPublica reporter. We're going to link to your 2022 report, Rent Going Up, One Company's Algorithm Could Be Why. And we're going to have you back on to talk about the baby formula shortage and what the U.S. government can do about it. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, community radio.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 21st. Your contribution goes towards grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this special membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, a Portland preschool files a lawsuit against Multnomah County for building a drug deflection center nearby. An Oregon group wins a federal grant to train indigenous youth on conservation work. And in national news, presidential candidates debate the terms of their upcoming debate. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 27, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. A Portland preschool sues Multnomah County over their decision to build a new drug deflection center nearby. They argue that the advisory committee that decided to place the center there violated Oregon public meeting law. They say the team that deliberated and voted in private should have made their decision publicly. Oregon law says that the public requirement applies to elected government bodies, but it makes an exception for advisory committees that make recommendations to elected positions. County Chair Jessica Vega Pedersen convened the committee, and she maintains the advisory committee could meet in private and that there were county-level deliberations in public. The deflection center is part of the rollback of Measure 110, Oregon's drug decriminalization measure. On September 1st, drug possession becomes a misdemeanor again. Counties across Oregon can receive $20 million in funding to create deflection programs, ways to keep people arrested for possession out of jail and into treatment. In Multnomah County, the deflection center won't be open until late October, and sobering beds at the facility won't be available until early 2025. The lawsuit could create another roadblock to opening the deflection center on the timeline County Chair Vega Pedersen had outlined. A $300,000 grant from the Interior Department is going to an Oregon organization to train tribal young people in conservation. It's part of the agency's Indian Youth Service Corps. KBOO's Jen Ofton has more on the story.
Federal grant money is supporting an Oregon group that rehabilitates the land and trains tribal youth. The Interior Department's Indian Youth Service Corps has awarded the Lomakatse Restoration Project $300,000. The funds will support the organization's Tribal Youth Ecological Stewardship Training and Employment Program. Head of the project, Marco Bay, says the Indian Youth Service Corps supports tribal young people aged 18 to 30 and up to 35 if they are veterans.
What it's focused on is providing paid-to-train opportunities for tribal members to work on their ancestral lands or neighboring ancestral lands, engaged in ecosystem restoration or eco-culture restoration work.
The Lomakotsi Restoration Project has been around since 1995 and is based in Ashland. Bay says the focus is on ecosystem resilience and reducing large wildfires that have become more prevalent and destructive in recent decades. The organization works in Oregon and Northern California. The goal of the Indian Youth Service Corps grant is for the organization to train 12 tribal youth from 7 tribal communities on restoration in Southern Oregon. The group's Tribal Partnerships Director, Belinda Brown, says the program will prepare the young people for careers in forestry work.
The success is the youth having family wage jobs, of them being able to contribute and help their family, of them being able to be successful in their community, which elevates them to the mentors for that next generation.
Bay also says the goal is to include tribes in restoration and management work.
This gives an opportunity to get the lands treated in an ecological way and to get cultural fire ultimately back on the ground, incorporating indigenous traditional ecological knowledge with Western science into the work.
For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Jen Often.
A new poll of Portland voters indicates there is a lot of support for funding city parks. 2/3 of voters say they would support a ballot measure to increase property taxes to fund city parks. A smaller majority say they would support a property tax increase that would support Portland parks and arts programs, provided that it ends Portland's standalone arts tax. Officials say parks programs and services are in danger of not being funded at the current tax levy because of inflation and rising material and labor costs. Portland officials are considering a ballot measure to combine parks and arts funding that could be on the ballot next May. The poll was conducted by FM3 Research, and it was conducted in mid-July with over 600 Portland voters surveyed. A new study from the University of Maine finds the United States could meet its entire seafood needs through its own domestic production. But researchers note that achieving greater seafood independence will require shifts in consumer behavior and continual adaptation in the face of climate change. Catherine Carley has the story.
A new study from the University of Maine finds the nation could reduce the amount of seafood it imports and still meet consumer demand. Americans ate roughly 20 pounds of fresh, frozen, or canned seafood per person in 2021, but roughly 80% of it was imported. Associate Professor of Marine Policy Josh Stoll says the impacts of climate change on marine populations may force consumers to shift to a more regionally sourced diet.
I think what we are consuming today from a seafood perspective may not be what we consume in the future.
Stoll says some species may leave the warming Gulf of Maine, for example, while new ones arrive. He says by focusing on species such as herring, anchovy, and other less consumed fish, the U.S. can create a more sustainable seafood supply. Critics note Americans may not be easily persuaded to give up their seafood on demand. Still, increasing domestic production of seafood will not only benefit coastal communities, according to Stoll, but it could also help address food insecurity. More than 10% of Maine households struggle to meet their daily nutrition needs. Stoll says even in a state like Maine, fresh and affordable seafood can be hard to come by. He says greater government investments in infrastructure will be key.
There's so much more potential for the domestic seafood production sector in the U.S. to play a bigger role in feeding our communities, feeding the people in our country.
Stoll says local communities would benefit from greater investments in cold storage, waterfront access, and regional distribution networks to ensure seafood is widely available, especially in historically marginalized communities. He says as more people pay attention to the relationship between health and diet, now is the time to aim for seafood self-reliance. For Maine News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
Presidential candidates are debating the conditions of their debate, specifically about whether or not microphones are muted when a presidential candidate is not speaking during the official debate. Representatives of Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are arguing in advance of a high-stakes September 10th debate over whether microphones should be muted except for the candidate whose turn it is to speak. That condition was already accepted by both of the then-candidates for their June debate hosted by CNN. Harris and Trump are both under pressure to deliver a strong performance next month. Many point to Biden's poor performance in the first debates as the reason he ended his campaign. Both sides are already accusing the other of gaming the system to protect their candidate, and Trump has even raised the possibility that he might not show up. Biden's campaign team made microphone muting a condition of its decision to accept any debates this year. Some aides now regret that choice, saying voters were shielded from hearing Trump's outbursts during the earlier debate. Even so, unmuted microphones likely would not have helped the incumbent's poor performance. The Harris campaign now wants microphones to be live at all times, according to her spokesman, Brian Fallon. Fallon said, quote, "Trump's handlers prefer the muted microphone because they don't think their candidate can act presidential for 90 minutes on his own," end quote. He added, Harris is poised to deal with Trump's constant lies and interruptions in real time and said, quote, "Trump should stop hiding behind the mute button," end quote. Trump spokesman Jason Miller responded that the Republican nominee had accepted the ABC debate under the same terms as the CNN debate. Miller also insulted Harris for not sitting for an interview or holding a news conference since Biden ended his re-election bid. Miller said her campaign now wants, quote, "to give her a cheat sheet for the debate," end quote. Trump said this weekend that he prefers a live microphone and that he isn't preparing for the debate. Probably complicating the negotiations this year is the fact that the debates are being set up on the fly by host networks as opposed to the Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. That organization would usually negotiate debate rules privately. Microphones have been unmuted at most previously televised presidential debates. The debate commission announced that a October 2020 debate would have microphones muted after the first Biden-Trump contest descended into a shouting match. The second 2020 debate, with its microphone muting rules, was widely said to be more substantive than the earlier contest. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. supports Donald Trump after ending his own presidential campaign. Trump may be trying to back out of the September 10 debate with VP Kamala Harris. And GOP House members are split on how to investigate former President Trump's assassination attempt. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It's with a sense of victory and not defeat that I'm suspending my campaign activities.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has indefinitely suspended his presidential campaign and is now withdrawing his name from the ballot in the battleground states. He says that's to help former President Donald Trump, but it's not clear what impact it will have. Support for Kennedy dropped after Vice President Kamala Harris became the Democratic nominee, and polls suggest most voters who abandoned him in the last month decided to back her. Kennedy's name will likely be on the ballot in most of the other states. Meanwhile, Trump is hinting he'll back out of the September 10th debate with Harris. Though Trump agreed to the face-off on ABC, he's accusing the network of bias and says he'd much rather have it on NBC or Fox.
I think it's disgraceful, and I think ABC is a disgrace. I think having Donna Brazile sitting on that panel, and she's the one that gave the answers and the questions to Hillary Clinton before a debate, I think ABC is really should be shut out.
Next month's debate was initially to be the second face-off between Trump and President Joe Biden before a poor debate performance led to Biden leaving the race. After Harris took his place, Trump agreed to meet her on the 10th. Trump's special prosecutor Jack Smith is appealing a ruling by Judge Eileen Cannon dismissing the former president's classified documents case. Cannon says Smith was illegally appointed because of how special prosecutors are funded. Smith is arguing his appointment follows a structure, including funding used in previous cases. Legal experts have questioned several of Cannon's decisions, many of which favored Trump, who appointed her to the bench. Several GOP members of Congress expressed frustration with the investigation into Trump's attempted assassination at a forum hosted by the Right Wing Heritage Foundation. The House-approved bipartisan probe led by a panel of House lawmakers, Florida Representative Corey Mills, says it's moving too slowly.
If this was to have been conducted correctly, then July 14th, we would have had immediate subpoena to get the security plans, comms plans, the motorcade operational plan, the actual counter-snipers range fan data cards, and started questioning the individuals independently.
Florida Republican Representative Laura Lee is one of those on the investigation and was not at the Heritage event. She reviewed the site of the shooting and says that provides a better understanding of the security failures.
For many of us, it raises more questions than we came here with today, because we can see it's not a large place. We can get a sense of the area and just how close these buildings were to that stage where President Trump stood that day.
Nevada lawmakers are considering changes to the state's election law. Though most proposals are minor, a divisive bill would allow former felons to become poll workers. Douglas County Clerk Treasurer Amy Bergens thinks that's all right.
I know a lot of people that have a past that they're not necessarily proud of, but they have changed their life. And so I don't think we should hold it against them what they did.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $30,000 by September 21st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, EcoJustice Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 55 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 78. Today in history, in 2016, the Australian Major Mitchell cockatoo, Cookie, passes away. Cookie was the oldest recorded parrot, living 82 years, far past the average lifespan for his species. The quote of the day is from German philosopher George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, born this day in 1770. He said, quote, "Poetry is the universal art of the spirit, which has become free in itself and which is not tied down for its realization to external, sensuous material. Instead, it launches out exclusively in the inner space and the inner time of ideas and feelings." A new coalition is targeting unregistered Native voters in the Mountain West states to get them registered ahead of the 2024 election. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Census data shows that roughly 1 in 4 Native Americans are not registered to vote. But in recent years, 3 states in the Mountain West region have passed laws to allow tribes to register them automatically. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
Native Americans often have to travel long distances to register to vote. Many don't have access to postal service, making it hard to register through the mail. And the lack of internet makes it difficult to do it online. Allison Neswood is Navajo and a staff attorney with the Native American Rights Fund.
All of that is rooted in, you know, the historic treatment of Native American communities. And so it's, I think, our collective responsibility to make sure that our communities can overcome these barriers and have a say in, you know, the leadership that impacts our communities every day.
Colorado, Nevada, and New Mexico now give tribes the option to use automatic voter registration. Michigan does as well. That could mean eligible citizens are automatically registered when they enroll in a tribe. So far, no tribe is doing this yet, but many are working with the states on the implementation details. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
Federal grant money is supporting an organization that rehabilitates the land and trains tribal youth. Eric Tigetoff has more.
The Interior Department's Indian Youth Service Corps has awarded the Loma Katsi Restoration Project $300,000. The funds will support the organization's Tribal Youth Ecological Stewardship Training and Employment Program. Head of the project, Marco Bay, says the Indian Youth Service Corps supports tribal young people age 18 to 30, and up to 35 if they are veterans.
What it's focused on is providing paid-to-train opportunities for tribal members to work on their ancestral lands or neighboring ancestral lands, engaged in ecosystem restoration or eco-culture restoration work.
The Loma Katsi Restoration Project has been around since 1995 and is based in Ashland. Bay says the focus is on ecosystem resilience and reducing large wildfires that have become more prevalent and destructive in recent decades. The organization works in Oregon and Northern California. The goal of the Indian Youth Service Corps grant is for the organization to train 12 tribal youth from 7 tribal communities on restoration in southern Oregon. The group's Tribal Partnerships Director, Belinda Brown, says the program will prepare the young people for careers in forestry work.
The success is the youth having family wage jobs, of them being able to contribute and help their family, of them being able to be successful in their community, which elevates them to the mentors for that next generation.
Bay says the goal is also to include tribes in restoration and management work.
This gives an opportunity to get the lands treated in an ecological way and to get cultural fire ultimately back on the ground, incorporating indigenous traditional ecological knowledge with Western science into the work.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A group of senators is pressing the U.S. Department of Agriculture to fix problems with the food distribution program on Indian reservations. There's been widespread disruptions in food distribution since April. The program provides food to income-eligible households on reservations across the country. It's experienced delays, missed food deliveries, partial deliveries, and deliveries of expired products. Many families who use the program are said to be receiving less food or no food at all. A bipartisan group of senators sent letters to USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack, pressing him to urgently address the problems. The disruptions are said to be impacting more than 100 tribal organizations and thousands of people. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Water shortage headlines might not appear in every state, but during a key awareness week, outreach specialists hope residents still realize the importance of protecting this resource for future generations. Mike Moen has more in North Dakota.
World Water Week is underway as leaders forge discussions on the global water crisis. Supply issues aren't as urgent in North Dakota, but that doesn't mean conservation is an afterthought. Danny Quissel with the North Dakota Water Education Foundation says the state is lucky to sit on a more predictable water supply, namely the Missouri River, when compared to elsewhere in the U.S. But she acknowledges droughts in recent years serve as a reminder for state and local governments and residents to not take this precious resource for granted. At home, she says basic conservation tips still apply.
Being mindful on when we're letting the tap run, where you're filling a pitcher and then you walk away for a minute to go let the dog out or something, keeping in mind, you know, that water is running over and right down the drain.
She says that mindfulness should also come into play with other daily practices like brushing your teeth. As for policymakers, Quissel encourages strong communication across various agencies to ensure water supplies are prioritized when mapping out commercial and residential development. Surging demand and uneven regulations have plagued western states as key water sources dry up. Quissel argues North Dakota closely monitors water use around the state. As climate change threats take shape, she says that has to be the approach moving forward.
It's a mindset to have in wet periods and dry periods. I think you build those habits over the long term. I think it's important to be thinking about being a good steward of the resource to have available for our children and our grandchildren.
Agriculture is one sector that has come under scrutiny for how it uses up water for food production. But Quissel says innovation and technology have helped to address that problem. For homeowners irrigating their lawns, she urges them to run sprinklers at dusk or pre-dawn. That way, the water won't quickly evaporate in the midday heat. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Chinese analysts are back to the drawing board as they try to figure out whether a Harris or a Trump administration is best for China. Harris will maintain Biden's policies while Trump is expected to jack up a trade war. Chinese expect tensions with the U.S. to persist no matter who is elected. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. China's America watchers have the same tough job that faces Donald Trump's campaign, coming up with a new game plan after Joe Biden passed the torch to Kamala Harris. Here are four sets of issues that Chinese analysts are likely to address when advising top leaders about the U.S. election. First, Chinese analysts prefer predictable and stable U.S. administration. Right now, China's leaders characterize U.S.-China relations as having stabilized after years of contention over Taiwan, the spy balloon incident, and trade differences. They hope to avoid ideologically based confrontations, preferring to deal with people experienced on China who are able to identify areas of cooperation and not just disagreement. Second, Chinese analysts loyal to Xi Jinping's preferences want a U.S. president and administration that recognizes China's international status as a great power, prefers competition to containment of China, and refrains from undue interference in what China regards as its internal affairs, human rights, political opposition, high-tech development, and especially Taiwan. Third, Chinese analysts look at China's long game in Asia and globally and ask which kind of U.S. leadership gives Beijing its best chance to accomplish its aims. Both parties believe China is the greatest threat to U.S. national security. Still, which U.S. administration might nevertheless accept China as a competitor for leadership in Asia, rather than seek to block it diplomatically, militarily, and commercially? And fourth, Chinese realists will consider how the next U.S. administration is likely to respond to the currently most difficult international situations that divide the two countries: Russian policy in Ukraine, trade and tariff differences, Taiwan, and competition for influence in diverse places, such as the South China Sea, the Middle East, and the West and South Pacific. How do Democratic and Republican candidates probably stack up in Chinese thinking when these four avenues of inquiry are used? Kamala Harris is likely to stick closely to the Biden policy on China, strengthening coalitions in Asia to deter any aggressive Chinese move, limiting high-tech exports to China as part of a de-risking trade policy, and criticizing China's repression of human rights. Harris will keep reminding Beijing of the costs to its relations with Europe that arise from China's ongoing support of Russian military industries in the war on Ukraine. But a Harris administration will maintain regular high-level diplomatic engagement with China, especially with an experienced China hand in Tim Walz. Harris has never visited China. The Harris administration will be one the Chinese believe they can work with on issues such as visas for Chinese students and researchers, the fentanyl trade, climate change, public health, and military-to-military communication. The Chinese already know what to expect of another Trump administration. After all, not only did they deal with him for 4 years, they have also read the Project 2025 playbook. They will have to prepare for a new round of tariff wars, significant decoupling of the two countries' economies, and sharp limits on Chinese investments in the U.S. Trump's advisors on China policy will be dogmatically hostile to China, just like his previous team. Diplomacy with China will be downgraded, and hostile confrontations over Taiwan and in the South China Sea may occur more often, despite Trump's personal reluctance to defend U.S. interests in either locale. China is also likely to find the Trump administration uninterested in negotiating over nuclear arms, educational exchanges, or climate change. But Beijing will be happy to hear nothing from Trump about human rights or about China's support of Russia in the Ukraine war. It might seem that China's balance sheet slightly favors a Harris presidency, but some Chinese analysts argue that Harris and Trump are equally problematic for China, that tensions with the U.S. will persist no matter who occupies the White House, and that both candidates favor less trade exposure to China. Other analysts, however, see Trump's tariff threats as posing the greater danger for China's economy. And some Chinese analysts see Trump as the better bet, maybe the admiration of one authoritarian regime for another, despite Trump's self-interested and unpredictable leadership style and his high tariffs. They will also be influenced by Trump's infatuation with Putin, his reluctance to get the U.S. into confrontations abroad, and his devaluing of U.S. security alliances such as NATO. Perhaps most important of all, the Chinese may be convinced that another Trump administration will cause major convulsions in U.S. society, undermining the U.S. willingness or ability to compete with or threaten China. So, as much as a Harris-Waltz administration would promise more reliance on diplomacy in search of common ground, it's Trump's weaknesses and vulnerabilities that might win over Chinese preferences. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 27, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, Jen Ofton, and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Catherine Carley, Mike Moen, Antonia Gonzalez, and Edwin J. Vieira. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
Making contact. This is Making Contact, and I'm Anita Johnson. And I just love talking to comedians. I appreciate how they bring their personal life experiences to the stage and allow us to laugh with them. The funniest jokes are the ones that we can relate to, the ones that bring us back to the moments we've gone through in life. And comics that are vulnerable and exploring those real life moments use comedy as a tool to tell the truth about society, about culture, and about all things that are happening around them. My next guest, Corinda Dobbins, is that kind of comedian. Corinda's debut album is called Black and Blue. And in all her lighthearted humor, she has a way of making us reflect on serious issues like COVID.
One of my first shows I did after, you know, we got out of lockdown, I was doing a show and I was at the bar trying to turn in my drink ticket because, you know, that's how they usually pay us. So I was there trying to get my payment. And this guy was at the bar. He was eating his food and I was letting him know, you know, that I was staying safe. I was like, sir, I'm going to be 6 feet away from you. Like, I'm not going to breathe on your food. Everything's good. And he said to me,